Welcome to the Business Isn't Usual podcast by Right Way. My name is Stuart Wilkinson and I'm the host today for this episode. In this podcast, we're going to be focusing on topics relevant to New Zealand business owners, and today's episode is going to focus on hospitality. We're going to be looking at how we can provide some practical ideas, tips and advice on how hospitality businesses can move their business forward, especially in a time which has been particularly challenging for this industry. Today we catch up with Casey Dalton. Casey is based in Wellington and is our business advisory specialist and has a large range of hospitality businesses he works on with in Wellington. He's also been working with these clients through lockdown and post-lockdown through this recovery that we're all going through at the moment. And he's just going to be sharing some of the ideas and tips that he's been working with his clients and how you can use them in this in your business. We look at the foundations of any hospitality businesses, how you measure them, what's the process you can start to put in place to get visibility on the things that you can control, which overall will make a massive difference to your bottom line in your business. For all references today, make sure you check out the show notes wherever you're listening to this podcast. And if you've enjoyed this episode, make sure you subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. To keep up to date with all the news from Right Way, check out our social media channels and hope you enjoy the episode. Casey, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, good day. Thanks for having me.
So, Case, today we want to talk about hospo, and I think the hospitality industry as a whole, we know, has been one of the main industries that through COVID-19 and the lockdown was, you know, massively affected along with tourism. And I guess you've obviously worked with a lot of Wellington-based hospitality providers in a range of, you know, different, I guess, themes and genres of what their offering is. I guess starting point is now we're, you know, a good month or so out of lockdown, nearly 2 months now. What do you see the recovery has been for the hospo industry, especially with we've had things like school holidays? But what's the feedback you're getting from restaurateurs, cafe owners, etc. in Wellington on what their thoughts are about how things are going?
Yeah, so it's been interesting. It's been a bit of an accelerator, I'd say. So in saying that, the people that have their key fundamentals sorted, so they've got a good business going, they are doing well. So recently met with a client who's had the best month he's ever had, so he's doing better. Funnily enough, he said that he was too scared to say that to anyone. When people ask how he's going, he's like, "Oh yeah, it's okay," and changes the subject because he doesn't feel
feels
appropriate.
A bit guilty about
when other people are struggling, which is interesting. At the same time, there's other businesses that had issues prior to COVID, and it's kind of being a catalyst for that change. So we are seeing bars and restaurants close, and we've seen some big groups die and some new ones pop up and are sweeping up all these places. So it's definitely hard. It's good and bad, but I don't think it's changed the core dynamic of hospitality, if that makes any sense. The key challenges are the same, and actually the solutions are mostly the same as well.
So in some ways, they're like, you know, we talk to a lot about on this podcast, but also internally at work, you know, if you had issues irrelevant of your industry going in, Casey, to COVID-19 and the disruption that caused for any business, that was, you know, you were always going to be facing problems. But I guess to your point, yes, hospo, the fact that they couldn't trade for a really good long period of time was a struggle. But if you had good structures, good principles, good metrics and foundations in place, you come out because you can then hit the ground running, I guess, once things have picked up again.
Absolutely. I mean, it took, and I'm not wanting to minimize how tough that lockdown period was. It required a lot of work with our clients and planning, because the wage subsidy was a massive help, but it wasn't everything. So it took talking to landlords, it took negotiating with suppliers, making sure you're on top of all of that to survive, and it was still a cash flow hit. So, but what we're finding is that the actual core demand, whether this is a spike or something, we'll see, but core demand is actually good. When people got out of lockdown, they wanted to eat and they wanted to drink. So so if you were there and you were set up and had your systems going, then there was an opportunity here.
Just on that, you obviously talked about the wage subsidy helping the hospital industry massively. We're obviously aware September the 1st, this the wage subsidy comes to an end. Have you got concerns that at that point we will see the either you've made it and you'll be fine, or we're going to start to see people really dropping off? What's your sense around the drop off of the wage subsidy?
I think the money has been spent. So the drop off date of September and that is a bit of a misnomer in that if I'm acting for a client that's realised that it's not going to work, they've got the money, they've committed to pay their staff for this next period, but they probably aren't trading. I know a bunch of them that have shut their doors because you still have to pay everything else, even if a portion of their wages are paid. So the drop-off is happening now, if it's happening. IID's records will show a big drop-off in September when these places mark these employees as no longer being employees. Yeah. So the payroll tax will drop massively, but I think the businesses that are surviving or not surviving, that's happening right now. There will be more, but I don't think suddenly the economy is going to take a turn on that day.
Because what you're saying, Casey, the decision's already been made by a lot of people. They're obviously, as you said, supporting their employees till the end of that, but they know that there's no point, because the minute you open the doors, there's cost in the business, isn't there?
I mean, once you got the check from the wage subsidy, you've committed to pay your staff for that long. But if you have a supplier screaming in your ear, you've probably used it to pay him, or you've done what you need to do to get back open. So it's not, there's no separation of money. That money is gone. And so you've either got core fundamentals that are going to keep you going through this, or you haven't. Not to say that there's no hope. You can turn around quickly, but you do need to focus on that.
And today's discussion and what you're going to go over, Case, is about those core principles. And as you said, restaurants, bars, cafes you've been working with, they've got these right pre-COVID have come out well. And even when we were in level three, I know you've worked with some clients at level three, they could really even make that work and with the core principles. So what do we mean by core principles in hospitality?
Well, not to get too accounting, but there's with hospitality, there's only a few key lines. Most of the costs that you spend are all really minor. The only things that matter really are revenue, so how much you sell, and that is how to attract customers, and all of that is its own, probably the topic of a separate podcast. But suffice to say that there's revenue, and you can try and control it as much as you can. But but the key things that you can control with support from a good accountant is there's only three big expense items: rent, which you can control at the day you sign up for that, so you can negotiate that right at the start of your hospitality. You can do a few little short-term rent-free months or something around a COVID crisis, but basically you don't have a lot of control over that if you want to stay at that venue. So that is kind of a fixed cost. So once you've got it, you almost don't have to worry about it. It's just your baseline, I need to pay for that. So the other two key items then are food, your food and drink costs, so what it costs you to make the food that you sell or to buy the drink that you sell. And wages. Now, those two are anywhere, if you're really good, between 50 to 70% of your turnover. So for every $100 you get in, somewhere between $50 and $70 of it is those two items. So when accountants say, just focus on those two, it's because anything that you do there will absolutely dwarf anything you can do to save in office stationery costs or anything like that. They're the things that matter. So getting those two right are absolutely fundamental. And we'll talk, and it'll come up a bit throughout talking through it. There's percentages get chucked around a lot. Yes. And so just to spell it out and to put some context around it. So when they say food cost percentage or cost sales percentage, they mean the percentage, so it's food costs divided by sales. So, for example, my client had $100,000 of sales last month, which was a good month for him. And so if we say he's got a 30% food cost, it means it cost him $30,000 to make the food that he sold for $100,000.
Yeah.
Same with wages. If wages is 30-40%, if it was 40%, then that's $40,000 of wages to sell $100,000 of food and drink. So when we talk those percentages, that's what we're talking about.
So I guess a good part to start, and I think I was reading yesterday in the Herald, there was a big article on the Commercial Bay Mall that they've just opened in Auckland, and they were interviewing a cafe owner, and it was all about rent, because he said, when I committed to the lease, Commercial Bay, it's right by the most, you know, where the cruise ships come in. So he was like, everyone was sort of planning on, hey, this is going to be where, or tourism was going to be a main source of my income. So he's been able to negotiate rent. But I guess those stories now are going to become harder to do, as you said. But I think it's a good example is, if you haven't, and I know you could listen to, I think, every podcast we've done since we launched this, and we've talked about having a discussion about a landlord, but you can have a chat with your landlord, talk about the situation you are, but open dialogue. But I don't know, have you had any examples of what people have done with landlords?
I think what I would say with rent is I've got my good clients are looking at moving in situations like this, where they might say, well, if you got a place next to the cruise ship and the cruise ship's no longer come, then that's a solid point to be like, well, what's the terms of this lease? Maybe we need to change. So when I say you focus on food costs and wages, it's because it's the lowest hanging fruit. But once you know what they are, so you know, okay, I make $100,000 and I've got $30,000 left after I pay my wages and pay my food costs. If rent's 40, then you know, then that's it. You say, well, this can never work. I can never pay my rent and my wages and my staff, so I need to change. But what so often happens is people have that discussion and they go, well, this rent's way too high, but they realize, but their food costs are 40 and their wage costs are 40. And so they $80,000 of that $100,000 is already gone. And really, they should work on those fundamentals, get that right and say, I'm actually running well now. This is a good business, or this is what I could be if I do well. If I can pay my rent and pay my wage and provide my family on top of that, then great. If I can't, then let's make that decision now. But
So I guess if we start with that viewpoint there, Case, where you say, well, look, to understand if what the impact of rent is and if the model works, it's identifying what is my food costs and what is my wages. Now, that might be quite simple for us to say, hey, look, just find it out. Yeah. Is it as easy as that? Or what are the pitfalls that people fall into that? Because I think the one thing for any listener on the podcast that we talk about a lot internally at Right Way with all our clients is the quality of the data you're working from. And so what are the pitfalls of maybe not getting the right number when they look at those percentages, or what they look in zero, or whatever they're using?
That's bang on. So when I go through this with clients, we look at, it's easy for us to say, let's look at your food costs. Let's see why they're so high. And me telling you that you're 30 and you should be 25 actually provides nothing to you. It doesn't help you in any way. And so my first step is always, what's your point of sale software? What's the system? Because we're about to do a whole bunch of other steps that are going to help us get that data right. But you've got to make the choice right at the start that you're investing into a system that's going to do what you need it to. And that in the hospitality sector is actually driven a lot by the companies that do the point of sale software are also filling that space as well. So being a good Wellington boy and Hurricane supporter, there's a local company called POSBOS.
Yep.
So they do point of sale software, and they also have a very strong back end for the users and the managers of these hospital companies to do this. So we do a lot of work with them. That's not the only one. There's Vend and a bunch of others, but I have to plug the Wellington one first. But, but that's our first step is always, what are you using as a point of sale software?
So if someone's using, we'll say POSBOS, or just as you said, there's other hospital specific point of sale software and inbuilt stuff. Why are you starting there? Why are you not starting in what's in my Xero account? What is it that's important in that piece of software or that entry point, whatever you want to call it? Why is that the starting point case?
Well, I think the key principle to remember before we start diving into all of this is these percentages are the output, and there's a whole bunch of steps in the middle, and the input is just the data or the thing that the users are using. So by that, I mean the people ringing up the meals when you go to pay at the end. It's the chef putting the supplier invoices in and ordering the food. It's the actual people in the restaurant doing the actions that come out to this end result. And it's easy to forget that. And so that's why when I say to do all the bits in the middle, you need good data. And so treating the staff and the people doing as separate to that result is a recipe for a disaster.
Yeah. So say someone's got, they've got their POSBOS system running, yep. They've got that tracking. How do they start that process, whether it's food cost, let's use food costs, and then we can go on to wages. But, they're starting to want it to get really good understanding of food costs and what's influencing their food costs. What's the process you would take through a client, or what are the steps you've seen clients go through?
Yep. My step one, and this is true of almost every step when you start working on a business, this is beyond hospital as well, but it starts with a simple idea and it takes a lot of work to do it. So what we start with is we cost your menu. So you could get your physical menu out. We in POSBOS, obviously all of your menu items are in there because that's what the staff do to ring up your meal. But we figure out what each menu item costs for you to make. Now that is easy to say, but the sub steps within that are you have to go in and using a system like POSBOS, say you're making pasta, you've got to have the input. Okay, what are your portion sizes? What do you have? 200 grams of pasta, you have this much of the tomato sauce, this much for mussels. But then the tomato sauce, if you're a big restaurant, is a big bubbling pot that's got 20 other sub ingredients in it that go in. So to cost that one pasta dish, you have to keep going back. And every time you think you've got it, you go, well, but actually we use this topping seasoning, well, cost that. Okay, then you got to get the sub ingredients of that, and it feels impossible at the time.
I've never done this, but it sounds very painful. Like
it is.
Like and is that one of the reasons people don't do it? It's because that just seems so tough.
Yep, it does, and it feels unproductive. It can feel like hours of typing in system. And for what is the hardest thing is to visualize why you're doing this. But once you do that, it is incredible what comes out of that process. My client just finished this process. So they're actually at the next stage, which we'll get to in a sec, but we've costed their whole menu. It took a lot of time. What comes out of it, just for example, one of his suppliers had just been slowly getting more expensive and he hadn't realized. When he started putting the costs in, he goes, okay, well, let me get my supplier invoices. What does it cost me for a kg of tomatoes? That seems too much. He took that to his alternative supplier. He had two fruit and veg suppliers. They gave him a new price, went back to his normal guy, gave him the competitors, and they've just sharpened their pencil and dropped it. Now, the only thing is, he didn't know that he was expensive before he started the process. He had no idea. So only by knowing and therefore asking and the guy saying, wow, actually, the bugger, he does know that this is too much, did he get the discount? It's a funny little thing. If you don't know and you don't ask, you're not going to get. So the suppliers...
Just to interrupt you there, Case, but I think there's also the other part there of seasonality of your produce that, is that, not everything is a constant throughout the year and, supply and demand, depending on weather situations that affect crop price, Like apparently we've got this splurge of potatoes in the market at the moment because and whatever. But you know, like there's things that will impact those prices. So if you're not on top of them and being able, but also being able to make opportunities based on, hey, that's normally $10, but it's on sale for $6. Awesome, I'm going to make more margin. So I guess it's also produce is a very variable cost.
It's dynamic, yeah.
Yeah.
And that is the advantage of doing it in a system like PostBoss, which we'll get to in a sec. You gave me a perfect segue. But if you use it to record your stock coming in, then you see it as it happens. So you say, well, perfect. PostBoss thinks kg of tomatoes, it's suggesting that it's going to be $2 kg. Why is it $5? Or, yeah. Well, this is really good. This is actually really cheap at the moment. Why don't I tweak the menu to use more of the seasonal food? Or, cool, let's adjust that. You can adjust dynamically as you go. Yeah. And as you change that price in your system, as you get your supplier invoice, so pretty much straight away, all your menu pricing changes. And you go, well, we're almost losing money on this dish, so let's cut it.
Have you seen that situation case where people have gone through this process and some dishes are probably like, yeah, this is awesome, I'm making some good margin, and there'll be some that they might be barely making anything?
What I mean about whether it's worth doing this process, there is some low-hanging fruit, and I would challenge any restaurant owner to say that there isn't there. We, for example, had one where a certain type of alcohol they were selling, they just priced it at the same price as all its equivalents, but it cost them a lot more, had a better name in the market, it was more valuable. But they hadn't realized. But when we ran their sales reports out of PostBoss, he's like, look, that one's awesome, we're selling heaps of it. And it's because all the customers know that's the really good stuff, and it's as cheap as the... So he was selling lots of it. All he did is adjust the price, they started selling less of it, but their overall alcohol costs went up. So because people still wanted a drink, and his margin on that. So maybe if he sells the same amount of alcohol, money makes on it is massive.
It's consistent.
It's an extra 5-10%. And the thing with these is 5%. If you saved 5% on your overall food cost, that client who made $100,000 a year, that's $5,000 a month, every month. And you keep it. How else can you get a $5,000 pay rise for nothing? For not selling. No, you don't have to make a new dish. You don't have to come up with a new idea. All you have to do is not do something. Just not sell the dish that you lose money on, or replace the Chardonnay that suddenly got really expensive with another comparable one that's good quality, that has got a better margin. There are low-hanging fruit there.
In some ways, is that kind of the message around this exercise case, is that there'll be some glaringly obvious potential things you go, oh gosh, I didn't realize that. The tomato price is a good example, the one you use there, but also by just tweaking, you know, a percent here, a percent there, it's all these one percenters that actually it can end up to 10-15% across the board and have a massive effect on your overall margin for your business.
Absolutely, because the other side of it is, so there's the food that you buy that goes into the food, and there's the food you buy that gets wasted or thrown away, or that dish isn't ordered. And so a bit more control there all comes out of this process too. So when you're costing a menu, you've got to say, okay, I make a dessert, I make an apple crumble, say, that I make my wet mixture, all the fruit and the sauce and all that, and I make a dry mixture, the crumble on top. When you go, well, we do it in big batches and we use a kg of that, kg of this, and that, you start to realize, how much does that batch serve? Okay, the dry mixture does 16 serves, the wet does 12, which means you're never on a cycle, which means you're always checking something out. Because if you sell 12, then you've wasted 4 of the other one, or if you sell 14, then suddenly you've run out of one, not doing the other. And you start to come up with real operational changes that all it requires you to say, chef, let's just adjust the portions when you do these big batches. Do your normal job, but just chuck an extra can or something in that can drastically affect these costs. When I said something easy, when I say something like cost your menu, there's a lot of things that go into it, but each one of them have a massive impact on your business.
That's awesome. So once people have costed their menu What's stage two from there?
What's stage two? Well, still on food costs, I encourage, and this again is a bit more work, but I think is equally as powerful, is instituting a stock system. So doing a stock take once a month. Now that can feel like just coming up with a number to give your accountant at year end so he can do a report you don't read. But the thing is, it's actually an internal control. It's a way to figure out, well, what's being wasted. And on the alcohol side, if we're all honest, what's being drunk, what's disappearing. Yeah. It's just as important as doing a cash up and making sure that what should be in the till is at the till in the next day. And it's not about not trusting your staff, but it's just about having controls. So a system like POSBOS, what you do is you put all your supplier invoices in. You say, cool, I bought a 10 kgs of tomatoes. Cool, they're $2.50, which is what we paid last time, so I'm happy with that. Put all that in. Every time you sell a dish with tomatoes, it's going to take out that portion that goes into that dish. Yeah. And then at the end of the month, it's going to say, I think you have 2 kgs left. And you'll either, and if you've got none, it means you've either thrown out two, or your portion sizes are wrong.
Portion control gone over,
Or so it becomes a feedback loop. That costing a menu thing is not a one-time thing. It's an ongoing process thing, but that's powerful. It's this process of feedback loop of stock take, costing, pricing, portion. That is a good head chef's job and a good business owner's job, because if you've got a 40% food cost where you're going to be losing money and 25% in your singing and your family's going on holiday, the first 5% will be easy, and then it's going to get harder and harder as you get closer to what the system says you are. And this is how you do it. Because it can be really powerful, again, where a system changes your day-to-day decision-making. If you start to find, we've always got this leftover, this type of meat or this type of vegetable, then it probably means you're not selling it as much as you can. So you can control that. You can put a special on to get rid of it, or you can more easily just adjust your buying, buy your ordering list, make that more dynamic. So when you get to your chef makes his order on a Monday, what did we sell last week? Run the report, figure out what was sold, figure out what you've got. That kind of dynamic, quick decision making is how you make the money.
I'm going to throw a curveball question at you, Case, which I've just thought of. We've all probably been to restaurants where their menu is the equivalent of the Bible, in the sense that it's got 20 pages of options and stuff. Yeah. I'm thinking of this process, and I'm not saying everyone should necessarily go to a menu of 3 items just because you can. It's easier to cost, but is there something in that how you structure your menu, the amount of variety you offer? Probably in my head, I don't know this, I'm just in my logical head going, there's a higher chance you're not going to have control of your costs. The bigger the options you go out with to your customers, the variety of cuisines you offer, or the variety of, like, is there something in that, or am I just making that up?
No, you've hit on the nail on the head, and you'll hear it a lot if you ever watch Gordon Ramsay,
you get
what that show's called, where he goes into
Kitchen Nightmares or something. Swears a lot.
First thing he says, because if you've got a lot of dishes, you've only got 2 options, and assuming you're not a massive restaurant with 100 tables and they're all flying out the door, either you're wasting a lot or you're freezing it. So it's the only way you can control wastage. So then your quality drops, then people realize the food isn't as good, then your revenue drops, and it all gets bad. It's normally what he says on a control side, absolutely. It is more work to keep on top of more dishes. And the other thing is, and we'll get to in a sec, particularly around when we get to wages, is you have less control. So there are dishes just out of your control. Some of them make you more money than others. And it's not to say that you can just delete everything that isn't the best margin in the world because people don't want to just eat.
You will have this dish, customer.
Yeah. You want a kid's meal that's just pretty much plain pasta with a little bit of tomato sauce. Makes the restaurant a lot of money, but people don't want to eat it. So you want to be able to encourage people to have meals that are both profitable to you and good eating. But if they've got 30 options, you've got no hope. Yeah. So it's normally a real symptom. You can tell of a restaurant. You can almost diagnose it from how big their menu is.
Well, and I think like, and there's the analogy, use it in business and another situation, isn't it? Is when you've got five options, you make a decision quicker. So it's also, it's a bit of a sales part here as well. I think that, you know, you want to make it easy for a customer to make a choice, but also if you've got a group booking of eight and they've all ordered eight different things, and they still might, but you know, it's kind of, that's going to make it harder. Whereas you've got three there, two there. It's the economies of scale and the efficiency probably in your process in the kitchen. I'm making this up. I've been a waiter my first job. That's pretty much my experience with Costco. But you know, there's obvious process efficiencies you get, which I guess might go into labor cost, but it's also making it easier for you to manage the business.
You're absolutely right. I mean, and it's easy as an accountant to dive into, yeah, the efficiency, and that is all absolutely true. To have that many types of dishes, it's an extra chef cooking that while you do the other one and while you do the other one. There's definitely cost side. The other side is a really good restaurant. Those dishes should be their passion. They should be their joy.
Yes.
And it's hard to – and eating seasonally isn't just about making sure that he's got a good price on potatoes because there's lots of them at the moment. It's about that when potatoes are in season and fresh, they're beautiful. And so if you're adapting dynamically to what's happening with fresh produce, you're going to have better food, which is going to mean happier customers, which is going to mean more returning people. So there's non-financial reasons for doing it as well, but you'd be surprised how often they align.
Yeah, yeah. So any more steps in the food costing part there, Case?
There's probably a lot more, but there is a lot more. If you could do all of that with your accountant, you have probably got all of the low-hanging fruit. You've also probably found, if you're honest with yourself at each step and commit to doing it properly once, you've got a lot of process changes there. To make all that happen, you have to have a team that are on board with these changes. The chef, there's a big difference between someone who can cook really well and make delicious food and someone that can do all of this, that can dynamically adapt to the prices, that can think like that. Now, those are people that the whole different set of responsibilities, either they do it or you do it. And that kind of gets to, I've set myself up with a perfect alley-oop segue to wages. There's that wage cost. I think when people think about how to get that down, they mostly think rostering and being miserly with hours. They think, well, the only way it's going to work is if I just send all my wait staff home as soon as, not four, or whatever.
Yeah,
absolutely. And rostering is really important, and I'm not throwing off it. But there's kind of to keep it simple and high level, there's kind of two ways of doing it. There is places with really good processes. Now, I'm a bit loathe to say it in a hospitality discussion, but McDonald's is one end of the spectrum. They hire kids out of school. They don't even need to think. There's flow charts for everything. There's processes. There's steps. They have invested a lot in management and process and driving that, and then they get cheap stuff. Now, that works for McDonald's around the world. I think it's more a global strategy than one really tailored to New Zealand, but because of our reasonably high and increasing minimum wage, you'll find that you could probably get someone better for not much more than what you're paying someone. Because the other end of the spectrum, and where I've seen the most success, now this doesn't mean it's perfect for every scenario, but it is a very common trend for me in our best performing businesses, is less people, higher pay. Now, What I mean by that is,
it's probably, we may just pause there because there's probably a bunch of people who go, how does that work? Case like that, you've probably rocked a few worlds right there of cool. Just, but talk us through. Yeah, I know I'm about to, but let's just put out that's out there and stuff for some people.
Potentially. Yeah, it is. So, what? So if McDonald's is a spectrum and the other side is a smaller number of people that will get each paid more but do more for you. The other side of that spectrum is how much time you want to spend as a manager, or in other words, what type of manager are you? Are you the person that wants to have to be there every Friday and Saturday night because you know when you're paying someone minimum wage and they're with a bunch of their other similarly aged friends and this isn't their passion, it's a side job while they're training to do something else?
Yeah.
Those people require a different type of management. And that's still a valid business decision, and I've got people that do it, and great. But that requires a different set of challenges from you as a manager than the other side, where you have people that this is their career, this is what they want to do.
Yeah.
And so what the first group of people, staff, want from you is good working conditions and pay. What the other people want from you is learning and opportunity, most, and pay, because this is their career and they're trying to provide for their families with it. But what we've found most success with is if you have teams that motivate the people underneath them as well. So what I mean is you could have six front of house staff, all waiters and waitresses that deliver the food, or you could have one front of house manager and two or three wait staff for the same overall wage cost. So you pay your wage manager a bit more, you fire people that you find the people underneath them that want to do a bit more, and they are the ones that make the difference. I know some businesses that choose their front of house managers by their ability to say two more beers. You know, the classic thing where a couple of guys like you and me, Stu, if we were catching up for a drink and we were
both getting there about the maybe a little bit more and before you know it, it's just very easy to go.
If he's almost decisions made and then you're there, that's another round. And then, oh, you want some food? Yeah, okay, yep, chuck some chips on the table. That upselling.
But to this point, Case, like you've talked about that, you know, the ability in some ways for the owner to step out from the business. And you mentioned when we talked about the food costing exercise that it's can be seen as unproductive and it can be seen as, oh my goodness, that is a lot of work. Yeah. Is, I guess this is a kind of a bit of, there's a bit of a what am I looking, word I'm looking for? It syncs up here, doesn't it? Like if you've got good people that you can count on, that gives you the ability to actually start some of these exercises of costing, reviewing your numbers after each weekend. And, you know, like you can't, because you often, and I know we're using some of the TV programs, which are probably, you know, amplified the reality, but, you know, we see it often in businesses that are manic. It's down to, and it doesn't matter if it's hospo, building, marketing, whatever professional services. If you haven't got a good team, it is very hard for yourself to get out of the day to day and look at what is making the difference for any business. So I think it's an interesting thing. I think that if you've got good people, it probably gives you a platform then to really analyze and work on the old classic, on the business rather than in the business.
Absolutely. I mean, this something you'll hear from lots of restaurant owners is, how do I find good help? So it's easy to say find good staff, and it's harder to do. So acknowledging that, but what even if you have the good staff, it's not a complete checkout, because what they want is, most of them, if we're honest, want to have their own restaurant. They don't want to be working for you in a few years' time. They want to have their own.
Yeah,
and that is fine. The good business operators accept that and encourage it, because if you can get them going and towards the end of their life cycle with you, they're at the level of a restaurant owner. Imagine having a partner that's helping you run this restaurant. That's what we're talking about.
And they're imparting their knowledge onto the staff, and it's a cycle, isn't it?
You build that culture. So you do still need to spend the time. And it's one of those situations, there isn't just seek and then good seek, where you just go out there and you find the good people.
Advertise on good seek, you'd be fine.
Don't go to, no. you have to train them, and it is a process, so it doesn't happen straight away. But I think anecdotally, what we found is when you start this process, you will find who's keen to keep going and who isn't. And sometimes it's one of your favorites. It's a very emotive thing being a business owner.
Yeah.
Being responsible for people's lives. And you might have to let go some people that were really fundamental. But if they're not on this journey with you, then you're effectively just paying their wages with your savings until you run out. So you're not actually doing them a favor either. So that's what we mean by this is you might have to build them, but once you do have this team and you start to communicate this this plan, then you'll find who's on board with you and who can get there.
Yeah. Case, conscious of time, I guess wrapping up, is there, you know, there's a lot there and some of that might seem pretty intimidating. Where do I start in my business? You know, we've all been to, whether it's conferences or listen to a podcast or whatever, and gone, well, where do you, what's your sort of two or three takeaways? Like, you know, if people are like, hey, I need to make some change, I want to make some difference. What's your best advice of how they can go about that process?
My honest advice is to get some help. This is a massive project, and I could write all of this down for someone and say, cool, job done, I'm the perfect business advisor and I've helped them out. Actually, a lot of it is the emotional motivation to do it every day and to keep accountable and to not get scared when you get a big bill and you get a big GST bill and money's tight. We've had almost arm wrestles with business owners in the past where their chef gets sick or wants to go on holiday for a month. And he goes, well, why don't I just do those hours? Then I save $3,000 a month in wages. And like, $3,000 is nothing on what you'd be doing helping the business. That's 3%. Yeah. There's 3% hanging there just for a few hours, let alone you spending all your nights at the restaurant and never seeing your wife and kids. What I'd say is, get a support network around you, whether it's your wife, whether it's your friends. We obviously think a really good accountant is a massive difference to get that plug in there. but it's true.
I think without plugging ourselves too much, there is the benefit of someone that's not tied to this business, doesn't have the emotional tie. Because I think that's the thing with HOSPO particularly, and rightly so, it's often a thing of passion because it's a creative pursuit. It's about creating something brilliant for their customers. And so balancing that emotive of, hey, I want to create something brilliant with, yeah, but you're not making any money, is a very hard thing to sort of really get your heads around. And having someone that can actually cut through some of that and walk you through and support you through this is important.
And I think it's a relationship thing. So it takes, you have to find someone that is on the right wavelength with you, because sometimes it goes by that. Sometimes you need to kick them up the pants. Sometimes you need to support them and help them, because they will have a list that's 5 pages long of things that feel equally important and urgent for them. And sometimes your job as an accountant is just to say, here's the 3 things that will everything else you're washed your hands off. We've said, look, you can't get to those, I'm focusing on this, and that's all you do, and that's how you make progress, that's how you do it. So I'd say to summarize, I think get your technology right, start this, figure out how that can help you and always have a mindset of linking these processes back to the actions that you take every day.
Yep.
And then get some help to support you to stay accountable on that.
Yeah, awesome. Well, thanks, Case. And just for all the listeners, we'll put some of the links, like things like PosBoss and stuff. So if you want to check it out, and obviously we'll put all of the details for the things we've discussed. But thanks very much for your time today, Case, sharing your knowledge about hospitality. Thanks, Case.
Cheers. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Business Isn't Usual podcast by Rightway. If you want to find out more information about Rightway, simply go to www.rightway.co.nz. If you want to subscribe, please do that on the platform that you're listening to this podcast. And while you're there, please feel free to give us a review. If you want to keep up to date with other information from Right Way, check out the Right Way Business Hub Facebook group, where there's ongoing information posted weekly. Also, check out all our other social media channels for all the updates from Right Way.